Welcome, everybody. I'm surprised to see there's more than five people here, but it's a pleasure. Welcome to our beautiful church in St. Stephen's Green. And if you are attending by webcam, or if you're going to look at us later, or indeed if you're here, we want to say that we want you to know that those of you who are lonely, this is a special service dedicated to you. And as we'll talk later on, loneliness is a huge part of our society. The late President Childers, once referred to it as Ireland's greatest scourge. And I think you can see it even walking down Grafton Street, even with the tinsel, the music, and the buskers. It's there, and it's very, very deep. So, my name is Paul Murray, and ordinary members of the church take over the service to give Bridget a break now and again. And it's a proud tradition, which we're very, very happy to have. So, if you feel lonely and feel isolated, especially coming up to Christmas, this service is for you. And as we'll say later, in other words, it's for everybody, because at some stage in our lives, we all feel lonely. We'll now light our chalice, which is done in Unitarian churches all over the world, and we will dedicate it to the earth's lonely people. If I can get the... You'll have to get new matches, Bridget. So, if you have been bereaved or dealing with a broken relationship, love but in return are unloved, or if you are on the periphery, marginalized in your place of work, among your social group, your family, or even in this church, let it be known that we are with you today, that we all, for all our inadequacies in this church, are your friends. Our first hymn, Come Sing a Song with Me, number 346. Let us pray for the discernment, for the patience, the grace, and the listening skills to be a quiet support for those around us for whom loneliness is a constant condition. We will now, if you wouldn't mind, go to the back of the book. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge in freedom, to serve mankind in fellowship, intend that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine. This do we covenant with each other and with God. Our reader today is Aidan. If you'll bear with me for 1 second. Oh, there you are. Sorry. I didn't see you, Aidan. Sorry.
Good morning to you all. We're reaching a time of year when people like to make assessments and measure stuff, and what was the best film of the year, or best piece of theatre, or what was the best political speech. That's understandable enough. We want to know where we are. And sometimes we extend this to people, and we are encouraged to sort of assess our last year. Were we content with it? Did we feel we'd achieved what we set out to achieve? And sometimes this kind of punditry even extends further, and it asks people to reflect on their whole lives and sort of, how well do you think you have done? And sometimes you even ask, people ask you to measure yourself, to measure this achievement or lack of it by marking yourself 1 out of 10. So maybe you might reflect on what mark you would give yourself. But as Unitarians, we really wouldn't get involved in such low-level soul-searching. Ours is a much loftier pursuit. But just in case you were tempted to do this, I'll save you the trouble and give you the answer. So I'm going to read a little piece by Pádraig Ó Mórán, who is a counsellor and psychotherapist who has a weekly column in the Irish Times that I think is often very insightful. This column is entitled, "In Life, a Pass Grade Seems Like Achievement Enough." By now it's a formula. Whether it's the Great British Bake Off, MasterChef, The Voice of Whatever, or I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, those who get booted out deliver variations on the same statement. Just being here was a great experience. I have learned so much, and I have had so much fun. But how many really mean it? Those who do are wise. They strike a blow against the perfectionistic demands we put ourselves on, never satisfied with a pass, but always demanding a first. When I was going to school, 40% was a pass in any exam, and as is usually the case today. We are all quite happy to achieve that magic number. 60% was honours, and that was even better to achieve. But what we basically wanted was to ward off the ire of our teachers, and 40% was enough. Somewhere along the line, 40% ceased to be good enough, and today many third-level students would regard anything less than 70% as a weeping, as an occasion for weeping, gnashing of teeth, and badgering the lecturer. 40% would require lying down in a dark room for a long period of recovery. I'm not saying that they're all wrong. I'm more concerned with the marks we give ourselves when assessing our performance in the game of life. In that game, it seems to me 40% is indeed a wise mark to aim for. Much of life is random and unpredictable. The Buddha said a couple of millennia ago that whatever you think is going to happen, something will be different. Yes, this is a statement that lacks originality and would never score a first. But it underlines how little control we have over large chunks of our lives, so little that demanding consistent excellence is ridiculous. Consider this. We have or are having a pandemic, a war, disrupted supply lines, rampant inflation, and a climate crisis that will change all our lives beyond recognition. And yet some of us go around feeling bad because we have not performed perfectly. Are we mad? In light of all this disruption, getting a pass in life seems like achievement enough for me. It lightens the load and maybe gives us space to be ourselves. A really sad thing about all this, I think, is that when we hit that perfect achievement, that perfect promotion, our old enemy, imposter syndrome, might well appear out of the shadows. You know, if they knew what you really were, it whines at you and millions of others. Freud first wrote about this in 1925 in a paper called Those Wrecked by Success. Later he suggested that achievements that seem too good to be true can be accompanied by a sense of guilt. He himself felt this when he fulfilled a long-standing wish to visit the Acropolis in Athens. A psychoanalyst, Dr. Mary Lammas, has explained this by saying that this accomplishment, Freud believed, was unconsciously perceived as disloyalty to his parents because they could never have done this. Erik Erikson, who published influential work in the 50s and 60s on the psychological and social stages we all pass through, suggested that at the last of these stages can either be a satisfaction or at what we have accomplished, or despair at what we have not. As the population of the Western world ages more and more, people are falling into one or other of these later categories or stages. Maybe those who regard 40% as a pass in life are more likely to experience satisfaction than those who demanded an unrealistic 90%. This latter is left glumly comprehending its failure to achieve. But if you are in that latter segment, remember there's nothing to say you can't give yourself a 40% now and declare that to be enough. Then maybe you too will be able to declare that just being here was a great experience. I learned so much and I had so much fun, at least 40% of the time.
Anyway, the story I'm going to tell you, all you children around the world, is about a girl called Samantha. Now, the thing about Samantha was, she was regarded as a very lucky girl. She had absolutely everything. She lived in a beautiful house, and the house was so beautiful that when it was being built, the neighbors complained. They said it was raising the tone of the road, and it was making their houses look like hovels. So Samantha had everything. And you'd have guessed, she had an absolutely beautiful bedroom. The bedroom, it had a television which you press on the floor, which you pressed the button and it came up. She had a juice squeezer. She had, of course, a music center. Her curtains went cross and back with buttons that she pressed. And she had a wonderful, wonderful bathroom. And she had carpets. And the carpets were very, very fluffy, because they had to protect her delicate feet, because, as you know, little girls at that age, they go to ballet twice a week, and she had to be protected. But Samantha didn't know this. Her parents were very, very rich. Very, very rich. But the thing is, she didn't realize that the fees were so high in the school she went to that her mother had to work very, very hard. And perhaps the only thing wrong with the school that Samantha went to was that when her mother was trying to get the big SUV car out of the gate of the school to get onto the main road to go down the hill past the goat up to Dundrum shopping centre after school, that was probably the only thing wrong with the school. But then, like every child, just like people are lonely, Samantha sometimes could be very lonely, and sometimes very, very lonely. And What happened was the other children wouldn't play with her. When she made a joke, they ignored her. They giggled when she forgot something in class. Her life was a misery. She even stopped eating sweets. So her parents, finally realizing in their busy lives that something was wrong, they went to the principal. And the principal was a very wise woman. She was particularly good at collecting the fees for the school. And they went into the principal and they said, "What were we going to do?" And the principal said, "I know what we'll do. We will get a new swing in the playground and we'll make it a swing that, not the normal swing, but we'll make it one where the children can look at each other while they're swinging. So there'll be two children on each swing." So soon the swing took a while to come. They couldn't get workmen to do it, except if they did mixers, and the nun didn't want, sorry, not the principal, didn't want this to happen because it would be against God's law and all that. So the swing eventually arrived, and the principal went up to Samantha on the way into school, and she said to her, "Samantha, what I want you to do is, the minute the bell rings, I want you to rush out and go straight for the swing." So Samantha did that. She ran for the swing, and she was first on it, and she was soaring and soaring, and then she stopped a little, and another girl jumped on. And the other girl hadn't realized who she had sat beside, because no girl was allowed in the culture of that particular class to talk to her. But after a little while, the swing went up and down and up and down, and everybody started to laugh, and all the little girls ran around and they started to clap, and then the swing slowed down and Samantha got off and the other little girl got off, and people were laughing and people were beginning to say hello to her. And then eventually Samantha said to the little girl, "Why is everybody so cruel to me?" And Samantha started crying, and the little girl got a bit embarrassed. And Samantha said, the little girl said to her, "Well," she said, "you are very cruel to us. You keep telling us all the things you have. You keep telling us that you've had a new dress, that your daddy has bought you this, that that you're getting a new car in your family, that they're actually going to build a swimming pool if the neighbors allow it, and that you are always getting new things, but you never listen to us. When we tell you that we have something new, you always ignore us and talk about what you have." So there's a lesson there, and the children around the world will take their own definition or their own interpretation of what the lesson is. 5 days and nights alone in Dublin, in a Victorian square with three infant children, marooned, housekeeping, skivvying, never again to have her own money, never again to know the pleasure of a day's work, of being a good professional, of being independent, of enjoying the company of her peers, the camaraderie of her colleagues, to watch her husband when he became a judge become a recluse, not a dog in the manger, but a shadow in the bedroom, who every afternoon lay down with the curtains drawn, his Ireland of the 50s face, a brolly of pessimism, spokes protruding, to cook his meals and wash his underclothes for 45 years. Instead of researching the land laws in relation to tenure and ownership and altering society by applying her mind to these questions, she applied her mind to the question of whether or not she could afford to buy a washing machine, and later a pressure cooker, a fridge and a dishwasher. In 1944, she was the owner of a washboard and mangle, but by 1954, she owned a washing machine. And in 1957, a dishwasher. But She who had got first place in Ireland, instead of being famous for her brilliance as a lawyer, she became famous for making cakes and ice cream. Her ice cream with chocolate sauce, her orange sponge cake, and her meringues made her famous in the family. Her barm brack, studded with threepenny bits, the Sunday roast lamb, although she could do it with her eyes shut, took hours to prepare and put on the table for 1:30 when her husband returned from the golf course, the Sunday morning four ball, to which the Museum called all middle-class Irish males in the 1950s. At night, she wandered off to bed, alone, with a mug of Bourneville, her hot chocolate, and a saucer of biscuits. Lincoln Creams, the new biscuit of the era. She had that many brains, your mother, you could have dipped your fingers in them. Small surprise that at the end of her days, in her 80s, the little scraped barrel of her, the thin-lipped scream of her, the spittle-stoppered mouth of her, she was spilling over with rage. She who, on a summer's day in 1937, in the law, got first place in Ireland. Paul Durkin. Let us meditate. Let us examine our consciences, whether in our lives we have given or sought to give comfort to those who are lonely, whether we have remembered that, as John Donne wrote, no man is an island, and that we shall live in each other's shadows, Ersko a Chéile a Mhaireann na Daoine, as the old Irish saying goes. We will now have a period of silence, and Josh will bring this to a close with some lovely music, or I was going to say lonely music, with some lovely music. Okay. You remember Roy Orbison, Only the Lonely? Patsy Cline, Have You Ever Been Lonely? Have You Ever Been Blue? The Beatles, of course. Ah, Look at All the Lonely People. And then Celine Dion, Don't Want to Be All by Myself Anymore. Songs like these have echoed down the decades, and not just for the attractive music, but because they touch something deep inside us. The loneliness, which at some time in our life affects us all, and often at Christmas. Loneliness, of course, is a constant topic in all types of literature and philosophy. The existentialists say that life has no intrinsic meaning and that we have to make our own meaning and that we are on our own. This has, it is said, left a lasting impression on Western culture, reinforcing individualism. In literature, even the titles of so many books and films will tell us how loneliness is so much a part of what we are. At random, a number of works come to mind. The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, Alan Sillitoe. I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud, Wordsworth, of course. The Well of Loneliness, Radcliffe Hall. And, which I think is a marvellous book, No Drinking, No Dancing, No Doctors, Martina Evans' novel, which highlights the loneliness of living in a strict Protestant sect. And of course, we have our own Austin Clark's evocative, The Planter's Daughter, where the daughter's house, which was known by the trees, excludes the men in the pub who drank deep and were silent. And then we have The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, Carson McCullers, and of course our own John Boyne's A History of Loneliness and others. Emma Donoghue's recent book, Haven, in which a priest and two monks seek to find a remote space to escape from a sinful world, is more about solitude than loneliness. And this distinction is carefully made by all writers. For the philosopher A.C. Grayling, who died quite recently, solitude is the antidote to the world when it is too much with us, while loneliness is the unwelcome psychological absence of others. And of course, being alone doesn't necessarily mean that we are lonely. Francesca Spector, in her book Alonement, makes the point that our relationship with ourselves is the most important one we will ever have. Our romantic partners, family and friends may come and go, but our monogamous relationship with ourselves will always be with us. And she warns against staying in intolerable relationships in order to avoid future loneliness. So let's look at the experts. According to TILDA, the Irish Longitudinal Study on Aging, loneliness can damage your health. It's a critical public health issue. Its health danger is the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day, is worse for our health than not exercising, and as harmful as being an alcoholic, and twice as harmful as being obese. In her wonderful book, which I've relied on quite a lot, The Lonely Century, Norina Hertz describes how the Haredi sect in Israel, an ultra-Orthodox group, make up 12% of the population, and this is going to go to 16%. They have a huge appetite for a very delicious cake, which is full of butter, cream, salty cake, and a diet, and they also have a diet with little fruit and fiber. They're totally deficient in vitamin D because they wear all these clothes that cover them from head to foot. And the skin is hardly exposed. They also have more children than the national average, and over half of them are below the poverty line. Yet their life expectancy is higher than the national average. And most relevant for our theme is that they play and pray together and help each other in time of need. And only 11% of them say they are ever lonely, compared to 23% of the Israeli population. So on this example, and there are others, if loneliness can kill you, a lack of loneliness can increase your lifespan. And of course, we don't have to be alone to be lonely. Not so long ago, someone I know well felt he was inexplicably lonely at coffee a few months ago after Sunday service. And that was, if I may flatter us all, when he was among the gentlest, most sociable, most pleasant people on earth. That someone, of course, was myself. And it brought back memories of 40 years ago when, on a work junket to Bulgaria, I was lonely because at the tender age of 36, I was so old compared to my fellow junketeers, who, to make matters worse, were playing the mating game, forbidden to me as a husband and father. Or the rush in London to Sunday Mass, fueled solely or largely by a desire to see Irish faces and hear their voices. Or this year's Halloween revelation, when shepherding grandchildren around door to door in my area, I realized I didn't know most of my neighbors. We lived in parallel universes. Me, a retired single oldie, they upwardly mobile with young children. Now, these are small incidents and nothing compared to the momentous loneliness arising from divorce, bereavement, or loss of a home or job, but significant enough to help us to understand that loneliness can visit us all, even those of us who are fortunate to be happy or at least contented. Tilda, the longitudinal survey, finds that almost 33% of over 50s in Ireland experience emotional loneliness at some time in their lives, and 7% often feel lonely. Intriguingly, loneliness does not increase in a linear fashion. It steadies or decreases in the 50s to 67 before increasing again in older age. And some international figures are really salutary. 3 in 5 United States adults consider themselves lonely. In Germany, 2/3 believe loneliness to be a serious problem. 1/3 of Dutch adults admit to being lonely, 10% severely. And in Sweden, up to 25% of the population say they are frequently lonely. Maybe it's the long winters. 1 in 8 Britons do not have a single friend they can rely on. 3/4 don't know their neighbours' names, and 60% are lonely at work. So it's part of what we are, whoever we are and wherever we are. Michael Seagart, in his poetry Pharmacy, tells us that in his experience, the busiest and most popular people can often be trying desperately to paper over the loneliness they feel inside. Andrew McGee, a Dublin psychotherapist, quoted in the Irish Times in September, tells us that at least 10% of the population is lonely, and that figure is probably much higher. Loneliness, he says, is distinct to everyone and has no common cause. He then dispels some myths about loneliness. Myth 1, having friends, a spouse and family means you can't get lonely. Myth 2, loneliness and isolation are the same thing. 3, loneliness doesn't affect your health. 4, loneliness is an older person's problem. And myth 5, that loneliness is no big deal. Answering just one of these myths, that loneliness isn't a result of being on one's own, he says loneliness stems from not having the kind of relationships within which we feel able to communicate our needs, beliefs, and feelings. In the words of Dr. Rena Bajaj, a London psychologist, the lonely person may appear withdrawn or isolate themselves, be more anxious or stressed, struggle to connect in social relationships, have more of a negative view of life, distract themselves from their emotions and keep overly busy, find it hard to understand and express their emotions, and be more self-critical than usual and lack self-confidence. Back to Norina Hertz in her Lonely Century book. She brings us on an absorbing journey around the lonely world. She analyzes why loneliness is endemic and, with some graphic vignettes, focuses on the breakdown of community, the insidious inroads of social media into our domestic and private lives, and the scary new world of robots, which have become crutches to lonely people as they lose contact. A world where you can rent a friend, buy a robot to cater for your domestic health and sexual needs, and on screen for a price, watch someone else in Japan, a mukbang, eat to accompany you during your meal. All of this stemming from the deep loneliness of people who may be, there can be many reasons, but may be unduly shy or have neither the time, the opportunity, the education, the personality, or the physical health to form some real human attachments. When we talk about loneliness, we tend to think of it as being that we feel excluded, isolated, or misunderstood by family, friends, and perhaps colleagues. But Norina Hertz adds another dimension to the definition. For her, consideration of loneliness has to take into account our relationship with employers, with fellow citizens, politicians, and the state, and how a person might be lonely because he or she is excluded politically and economically. Hence, she blames neoliberalism as a cause of loneliness, a world of free choice, free markets, and freedom from government or trade union interference. Brutal competitiveness with ever-expanding rewards for CEOs and board members, widening the wage gap with the other employees. Microchipping of employees' hands, hot desking, noisy open plan offices with supervisory overload and constant disruption, and time scanning with toilet visits regarded as idle time. She highlights that in an increasingly greedy world, words like together, share, and duty have been replaced by achieve, own, personal, and special. The word I has replaced we and us. And how we have become consumers rather than citizens. How 85% of workers globally feel disconnected from their company and their work. And how only 30% of US citizens feel that most people can be trusted. And this is down 20 percentage points from 1982. And in the years before COVID, 66% of people in democracies did not think their governments acted in their best interest. Hertz blames social media for having played a pivotal role in stealing our attention away from those around us, fueling the worst within us, and eroding our ability to communicate effectively and with empathy. In the mix, too, of the drivers of loneliness is migration to the cities, fundamental changes in how we live, people are not there for their neighbours anymore, and radical reorganisation of the workplace. Loneliness, as touched on earlier, has many startling effects. In Japan, crimes by people over 65 have quadrupled over the last 20 years. Hearst says it's a life choice for many as they commit offences in order to go to prison and to escape loneliness. As one woman said, there's community in jail, there are always people around, and I don't feel lonely. And then Hertz goes on to mention what she calls the loneliness economy. To support and in some cases exploit those who feel alone. Rent a Friend, which is now in countries all over the world, and has 620,000 platonic friends available for our delectation. I looked it up, I checked it again, 620,000. Why do people hire such a company? And what type of people are they? We are told of a soft-spoken woman who doesn't want to show up at a party alone, a techie from Delhi who doesn't know anyone in Manhattan, and the typical clientele, I thought surprisingly, is the lonely 30 to 40-year-old professional, the type of person who works long hours and doesn't have time to make friends. In a sense, as social animals, we are losing the skill of being human. We are putting on the earphones to keep the noise out as we scroll through our mobiles on the way to work. In some countries, local authorities have put the little green man on the ground because what's happening to stop people walking across the pedestrian crossing? Because they won't look up. And we have been emasculated by our screens. We've been lost the art of interpreting facial expression when seeking to communicate. In the United States, some college students who had lost the ability to read a face sought advice from a relationship academic. Not, you'd imagine, on sex or the intricacies of love, but on how could they could ask somebody for a date in person rather than go on their phones or go online. Something I think we all learned by trial and error. Reading a face is vital in all areas of life, particularly in transnational situations. One of the five reasons why Walmart, the US store conglomerate, had to retreat from Germany was because the Walmart chiefs instructed their staff in Germany to smile at the customers. Germans, perhaps not always the most smiley of people, didn't take too kindly to this as they regarded the smiles as flirtatious. Teachers report that children are increasingly deficient in fundamental personal skills and language for their age. Hertz writes that at one nursery, the teacher gave out scripts to the parents on how to talk to their children. You know, Samantha, what kind of a day did you have today? The warning from Hertz is that all the time we are on our devices, we are not present to others. Even with couples, the empathy level drops the minute a mobile phone is put between them. What does it do to humanness when we turn on our phones the minute we wake up and check them 90 to a few hundred times a day? When we stop having lunch with colleagues because of work pressures, stop going to church or join parent-teachers associations or trade unions. When, as Robert Putnam in Bowling Alone wrote, stop doing things together. As has been reported before, younger people, believe it or not, are having less sex with a person. People in their early 20s in the US are 2.5 times more likely to be abstinent than 10 years ago. Togetherness, indeed, or more accurately, a need for it, perhaps explains something about Donald Trump and the rise of the far right in Italy, France, Belgium, and other countries. Hannah Arendt has said that totalitarianism is based on loneliness, from isolation and lack of normal social relationships. For those who feel they have no place in society, she says, it is through surrounding their individual selves to ideology that the lonely discover their purpose and their self-respect. Hertz writes that in the US Republican primaries, the Trump supporters were twice as likely as those of Ted Cruz to have seldom, if ever, participated in community activities. And Trump's rallies are now very much community affairs. involving extended families, people to whom Trump appears to be listening, people who he says are true patriots, beautiful people who have been undermined by immigrants, Democrats, liberals, take your pick, all tactics similar to those of the far right in Germany, Belgium, France, and Italy. So, what of the next century? Will it still be more lonely? Hertz seems certain of one thing. Robots will have a role in alleviating individual loneliness, and not just for older people. For those who, for whatever reason, find standard human relationships hard to forge, robots may also play a valuable role, she says. People with no special social skills, including those with extreme social anxiety or autism spectrum disorder, have already been shown to benefit from robot-mediated therapy and group activities. Older Japanese women knit hats for their robot carers, and there are transgender sex robots. We are probably a few decades away from a robot being able to appear empathetic as most caring and kind of humans, as the most caring and kind of humans. A world indeed, she says, in which robots might be given rights. This is a challenge our children and grandchildren will face, one in which they'll have to be increasingly discerning. A world in which already one survey shows only 18% of Facebook postings are accurate profiles, according to the people that posted them, where human contact is decreasing and artificial intelligence is displacing human-to-human relating. Norina Hertz has perhaps given us some forewarning of what is to come. In the meantime, besides being alert to the issues surrounding robots, we might take advice from the HSE for when we're lonely. Be assured, loneliness is normal. Everyone goes through lonely periods. Boost self-esteem by finding achievable things to do. Keep busy, volunteer, enjoy your own company, take care of yourself, start a hobby, and be wary of what you see online. To end, some thoughts on loneliness. The soul that sees beauty may sometimes walk alone. Goethe. All great and precious things are lonely. Steinbeck. The greatest thing in the world is to know how to belong to oneself. Montaigne. A season of loneliness and isolation is when the caterpillar gets its wings. Remember that the next time you feel alone, said Mandy Hale. And although the HSE left this out of its advice, if you are lonely when downstairs drinking Unitarian free trade coffee, don't let yourself be lonely anymore. Let somebody quietly know. With many thanks. The notices for coming weeks, and for now, fair trade tea and coffee, where one should never be lonely, is served downstairs in the Damer Hall. Please join us. Wednesday is the lunchtime meditation at 1:05, and that'll be in the church until 1:35 and online. There are copies of December Auskult on the table, please take it. Also copies of other magazines. Friday the 16th, the Communications Workers Brass Band will play a concert in the church beginning at 7:30. Next Sunday is our carol service. It's 3 years since we sang carols together, so bring along a family friend, bring along family friends, and to this lovely service. Afterwards, there'll be a sale of cakes, chutneys, and honey in the Damer Hall. So please, we do need cakes, and we need buyers of cakes. And the proceeds will go to our refugee project. And the proceeds of the sale and the offertory will go to the St. Vincent de Paul. January the 1st is our favourite readings, and volunteers are needed. Please contact Bridget. And the next book club is on the first week in January, isn't that right, Jennifer? First week in January. And the book is The Enchanted April by Elizabeth von Arnim. And finally, can I just mention, does anybody have a van or know anybody with a van who would be willing to drive it to Mullingar with rugs and maybe a few other things for our Afghani family who are now placed down there? If so, would you let me or a member of the committee know? That we'd be very grateful. And I think that's all. Yes, first, and note, thanks very much to Aidan for your reading. I'm sorry I didn't recognise you coming up to do it. Frank for the flowers, and then the catering corps of Frank, Liz and Dennis, and Kevin, who welcomed us at the door. And of course, as ever, Josh, who week after week gives us so much pleasure. Our final hymn is 129, Let Love Continue Long.